Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I'm your host, Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, producer, wordsmith, teriyaki, Jedi Cole Houston is with me. I don't know why.
It's actually Asian Cuisine Month here.
Is it? In the Jedi Cole Universe headquarters?
But not like real proper, you know, authentic, just the kind of American LaChoy.
LaChoy?
Panda Express.
Welcome to Hey Kids Comics, sponsored by Kikkoman. Kikkoman. The only thing I know that Kikkoman makes, besides, you know, your various sundry of sodium laden sauces, are those noodles.
Basically, it's marketed as either Chinese noodles or all brand.
Yeah, right, right.
Depending on, you know, where you're buying and how old you are.
Well. So, we're coming up on the end of a story arc, and things have been a little heavy for the first three issues of this story arc. I think that we both agree on that. We've covered a bunch of lawsuits, we've covered a bunch of thefts, and then we covered a bunch of, like, extremely destructive, like, personal art theft in the last one, and Thomas was nice enough to join us for that. He'll be making a reappearance in a small way in our last issue of this story.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, before we move into this much more upbeat, this is like the new DC movie approach.
It's not, though. That's the sad thing. Stop trying to convince yourself that's a thing that'll happen. It's not going to happen.
Well, you know, we this is a little more upbeat than past ones have been, but to drag it down just a bit, you know, it's funny how things will happen when we get into story arcs,
mm-hmm.
or when we're planning, you know, something. A lot of times when we're planning a show, something will hit just in the nick of time,
right?
And this sort of happened very recently. Andy, you sent me an article about the grandkids that took the grand out of grandkids.
Yes, yes. oh, God.
Apparently took it upon themselves to pilfer a portion of the their grandparents' comic collection.
Their comic estate. Yeah, this was a real deal comic collection. how much was it? Did they manage to sell off?
Some ungodly amount, because it was... they had basically gone to various comic shops under the pretense that their grandparents owned a comic shop.
Right.
God. And they wanted to, you know, they were just kind of selling off the leftovers, as it were, upon their passing. Well, Grandma and Grandpa were very much alive, and I should imagine very much pissed when this...
Right.
Yeah, but it was sort of like the latest real-life comic book caper.
It's like
30 grand worth of comics, according to the report.
Heavy amount, yeah.
You guessed it. It was in Florida.
You know, it's funny, because a good thing happened in Florida, and we'll talk about that in a second. But you're talking about the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, where if something enters your purview, if something enters your field of vision for, you know, and you start really thinking about it, it starts popping up everywhere. And that certainly is true. I'd like to do an entire episode of this show on that phenomena, because it's absolutely true, because the more that we were researching just, you know, the things that have happened in the past when it comes to real-life comic book capers, the more current things started popping up that you saw. It's a bizarre phenomenon that is absolutely, it's Schrodinger's comic book shame, really. If you put shitty grandkids in a box and close the lid, are they shitty? Are they still shitty in the box until you open the box? And I don't know. But yeah, it's Bader-Meinhof. But no, it's speaking of Florida, the whole purpose, the whole reason I was going through, you know, when we were putting together this chain of shows, I was like, we can't just beat up, you know, our audience for five issues about all this awful, all these awful things. So I really wanted to put something in that really showed the good that the industry can do. And I was thinking about how to do that. And then I remembered, listening to This American Life, there was now it's not going to start necessarily on a comic book tip, but we'll tie it back in. I remembered a story. Just the tip. Just the comic book tip. That's the name of our next podcast. skull. just the comic tip. We also are a little punchy. We've been trying to put together the story arc, and it's like we summoned the chaos energy out of the ether to talking about all this bad stuff to make the bad stuff happen. But I remembered a story about fantasy novelist, and actually he's done some comic work, but he's more well known for his fantasy authorship. Piers Anthony.
Oh yes,
Piers Anthony, prolific fantasy author. Like wrote the Xanth novels. I read them when I was young, but I was reminded of a story about what the power of positive art and in your community can do. And there was a kid back in 1987. That was having a really rough go of it in school. He was not unlike any of us were probably making an assumptive leap, but you know wasn't challenged in school. Very imaginative. Wasn't getting what he needed. But he felt he was being looked down upon and shunned for his love of Dungeons and Dragons and fantasy novels and that type of thing. So on a wild hair. Put together all of the money that he had, bought a plane ticket. Now, keep in mind, he was like, 10 or 12? Put together enough money to buy a one-way plane ticket to Florida, if that gives you any idea of the time period that this was allowed to happen in, that a 12-year-old could buy a one-way ticket to Florida and fly. flew to Florida to run away to Piers Anthony's house and live with him. Thought that would be
you show up and hi Piers,
right? Throw himself on prostrate himself on the good graces of Piers to say you are my mentor and role model, whether you know me or not. Take me in and teach me your ways. Sit outside the monastery. So he did it. He put together the money. Figured out because this was before the internet. Figured out through book notes, because Piers Anthony wrote these elaborate notes, just very personal, very, very in touch with his audience, almost transparent about what was going on in his life, anything from doctor's appointments to editors giving him a hard time to anything it might be. But figured out, did the deductive, almost like Tim Drake figuring out who Batman is, did the deductive research to figure out that Xanth was basically a map of Florida.
Oh yeah! In fact, there's a deliberate, Xanth is deliberately Florida peninsula shaped.
Right, right.
And there was in every book, the map became more and more elaborate. There were as more and more locales were filled in through time, but you've got Beyond Good Magician Henry, was it?
I think it was Henry.
Too long.
Yeah, I think it was Henry.
You got Beyond his castle and some other little places. Meet little by little the. There was always a mention that any similarity between Xanth and a mundane peninsula is strictly in the mind of the author who lives near the North Village, and you can easily work out that the North Village, I think, was Tampa.
Yes.
So you're halfway there. If you just turn right at the Ogre Finogre Swamp, then you're going.
But still, a pretty epic deduction for a child of his age. But figured out that it was either Inverness or Floral City that Piers lived in, because in the books he said he lived in Xanth, or the capital of Xanth was just south of the Unicorns. So he put together all this, extrapolated all this, and went for it. No car, no nothing, just went for it.
Yeah.
Got out there, made his way to what had to be what he figured was Piers Anthony's house. Got to Piers Anthony's house.
Probably went looking for castle-shaped houses.
Right? Went out to his house, and Piers took him in.
Oh, my.
Piers then contacted his family.
Yeah, by the way, I didn't kidnap your child or lure him to my home in some sort of strange, perverted celebrity way.
Right. He spent the night there, and then the afternoon he hung out with Piers, met his horses, went to those woods. Piers showed him. Now, in the meantime, he's secretly contacting the parents and being like, your kid showed up on my doorstep. He might be Batman. Can you come get him if you're still alive? Calling Crime Alley. But showed him. Because how easy would it be, and how many stories have we heard, about, get out of here, kid, you're bothering me. Rob Liefeld.
I really can't... Because, you don't want the floodgates of fandom being opened up, and pretty soon you're having to pitch tents out in the South 40 to accommodate your legion of fans because
So they got him a plane ticket back. He flew back, you know. But it really turned his life around. You know, he met his hero, and I also want to do a story later on down the line once we cleanse our palate fully about never meeting your heroes. This is one of those rare cases, and they are rare, where meeting your heroes was a very good thing because it helped him focus, it helped him turn his life around, it helped him realize that there are good people out there and people that will support you in your weirdness, you know, in your self-perceived weirdness. So that was what really triggered this for me, was like, there are people doing good work in the various, you know, geek quote unquote industries. And I wanted to focus on that a little bit. So that's where this whole thing came from. What's the title of this one, Cole?
This one is Comic Book Heroes. That's and, right. You know, at first blush, it might sound a bit like the least inspired title of the entire run of this particular arc, but I wanted to play upon the idea of the traditional meaning of comic book hero when you're listening to a comic book podcast, and juxtapose that against real life heroes without calling it real life comic book hero.
There's a lot of hyphens there, yeah.
Yeah, so it to kind of an economy of words.
Right. Do you have any stories off the top of your head about anybody in the industry doing? I mean, because the cool thing about this is I know Cole way more than I have, but we've met our heroes in the industry, a lot of them, and they have risen to the occasion. They've been amazing people. So, what is your best comic book hero story that you can?
Wow, that's a good question because there are so many people that you encounter on the convention circuit or just here and there. You know, one example that, you know, isn't on the giant dynamic doing good for us all type of level, but still nonetheless, I think some people develop a reputation.
Right.
Oftentimes on, you know, the word of one person who saw them at a convention or, you know, perhaps just by their very nature, they seem aloof or unapproachable. And oftentimes it might be a bit of a persona they have to take on because of the nature of their work. And James O'Barr is one of the most bizarrely fascinating men I've ever met because he had that going in, you know, before I ever met him in person, that reputation as being somebody who was just completely aloof, a little off-kilter, who was, you know, exactly what you would expect from someone who would create The Crow.
Right.
And the reality is he's a just an absolute sweetheart and a whole lot of fun. He just, you know, but you don't always, if you get him in the right, catch him at the right angle, it's like you have to run him through a prism.
Right.
And sometimes you get the indigo, sometimes you get the blue or the other bivolos, but you catch him just right, and you get to see this side that most don't, and I've had the good fortune to see that a couple of times. There was a friend of mine, Eric Shirey, his son was on our Captain Marvel show, or Shazam show.
Right.
Had arranged, he would like occasionally just like go and get people to come and do things, like make appearances. and O'Barr was one of them, appeared at like some kind of, I think it was when he was doing a Hammer Horror thing at Lone Star Comics years ago or something like that. You know, it was the first time I got to really meet him, and he did seem a little bit like what you'd expect. And then later on, when I became the MC, the voice of Strip, the Dallas Web Comic Expo, I was MC for 3 out of 4 years because somehow the first year got by me. He was there as a guest of the Dallas Web Comic Expo and stayed after, and we all stayed far too late doing the charity auction.
Yes,
and
as is wont in those situations.
Yes, exactly. he was working during the course of the auction on this amazing watercolor, just like it was just him and the medium, and that was it. That, you know, it's just amazing to watch with no references, no anything, and he produces this amazing work, which we bid on for a while, and then I realized, you know, there's no way.
It's getting there real fast, and it's not going to happen.
It was going to get beyond what I could pay, and then where would I put it? I guess I would find some way to have...
honored it effectively.
Yeah, so I'd have just, like, taken, you know, stuff down, like take the TV off the wall or something, but...
Well, and that's an interesting point about that, and we'll get into that more later. But if you've ever been,
he really just, you know, threw himself into doing a work that he could have sold for a ton of money,
sure,
and just, you know, he produced it there on the spot in front of everyone, and then you know, effectively just gave it away for the charity they were doing for, which I think was wonderful. But he was also what was really remarkable is there were a couple of times. And I'm going to go on record, I actually saw him smile.
What? You saw James O'Barr smile?
James O'Barr actually smiles.
The subtitle of this is The Man Who Saw James O'Barr Smile.
Right. And one of the fun things was they were, he had this, basically it was one of the cloth napkins from the hotel that he was using while producing this artwork. So by the end of it all, it was just this, you know, it looked like that invisible monster from Johnny Quest that they threw all the paint at.
Yes. Yes.
So it was just this melange of colors, and it became known as James O'Barr's Jizrag. apparently, it does that in rainbow colors. But he actually, I think Catherine had suggested that he autograph it. And it was auctioned off.
Wow.
And he actually signed it, J. O'Barr Jizrag.
J. O'Barr Jizrag.
God bless you. And it was just wonderful. And then sometime later, I saw him over at a comic shop one time when he just did brought a portfolio with him. He was just hanging out with some dudes.
Just
checking
chilling.
It out. Like, you know, here's some stuff that I drew, you know. Like fanboys would come in and show off their stuff. But you're fucking James O'Barr.
Yeah, but, you know, he's like, that's the thing is, like, when you get to that level, you still are, in a lot of respects, the ultimate fanboy. So for instance, my favorite story like this, and I don't have any grand James O'Barr stories or anything like that. I didn't run that close to that to any tight circle. The closest one I have is when Chris Sprouse was giving dirty looks to Daryl Banks while he drew me a sketch that Daryl Banks wouldn't draw me in Artist Alley at Wizard World Chicago, because Daryl Banks is a dick. I don't care if he draws Green Lantern and created Kyle Rayner, you're still a dick. But Chris Sprouse is a wonderful gentleman and brilliant Star Wars artist. Thank you, Chris Sprouse, for being my Pierce Anthony when I needed you the most. In the wake of 9/11, and we could do an entire show on the comic book creators and industry insiders that stepped up during that time period. You know, like we could talk, you know, not that we would talk about it, but Steve Buscemi joining, you know, volunteer firefighting. The one story that really stands out, because you got to remember, the big two, their main offices are in New York City, DC Publishing and Marvel. This is before, you know, this is before Disney, but I think their offices are still in New York City. There's a brilliant story, and the first time I saw it was I Know That Voice, which is a great documentary. I think I've said it before on Netflix, where it's all the voice actors. The stories of voice actors. It's got like Close, and it's got a what's her name that does a. I think she does Judy Jetson, and she still works. She's like 90, yeah. And she did what was the squirrel's name? Rocky. Rocky.
Yes. I know exactly what you're talking
yeah.
about.
They cut to at one point Kevin Conroy, who I have had the honor of meeting. He's a very nice man, but you know, you meet him at a convention, you know, in passing, and it's very much like, I enjoy your work. Thank you very much. That's it. That's all you get a lot of the time at conventions. And that's great. I'm glad that they're there for that. But you don't get these real intimate moments where he's talking about how he, in the aftermath, he was working in a in a relief kitchen, and he was cooking. He was back in the back cooking, and one of the guys that was standing next to him said, "I know your voice, man. I know your voice." And he's like, "Well, I mean, I did Batman on the." He's like, "I knew it. You're Batman. You're Batman." And he's like, "And the whole place is full of people. You know, like it's wall to wall people at the relief kitchen where they're serving food in the direct aftermath of 9/11." And they're like, and the guy's a lawyer, the guy that's in there with him. And he's like, "Hey, you really want to make somebody's day? Just stick your head around the corner and do Batman." And he's like, "I don't know." He's like, "Do it. Do Batman." So he sticks around his head around the corner, and he does the "I am vengeance. I am night. I am Batman." And everybody screamed. The first thing he says is, "I am Batman." And some guy in the soup kitchen's like, "No, you're not." And he's like, "Okay." And he redoubles his effort and does the whole line. And he's like, and the guy in the kitchen was like, "Holy shit, it's Batman!"
Nice.
And I mean, he said, you know, the cheers went up, and people started talking about their favorite episodes of the Batman TV series and their favorite Batman and how they watch their shows with their kids and how they watch them as adults. And he said for a lot of them, people came up and said, you know, in the week and a half since it happened, this is the first time I've laughed or smiled. You know, thank you. And that's all it took.
Yeah.
Is somebody to not be so full of themselves that they realize that they could have a positive impact just in something like that. You know, there's a fine line between being humble and being kind of humble brag. You know,
yeah.
And he definitely was, you know, he did that for a reason. I don't think he ever would have done it outside of that. If you've ever met him, he does not strike you as the type of person that that would be like, "I'm going to take advantage of this situation." But he saw an opportunity to uplift some people, and he took it, and that is so huge. And I think the other one, I think Cole might be able to speak to this more eloquently than I can, because I've been trying to wrap my head around how I want to talk about it, because we talked about it a little bit on the last show with and we're recording these shows pretty close together. We talked a little bit on the last show about Darwin Cook and his passing.
Yes.
And I've been working on a theory, not a theory, but an exercise where, and I've been working on this for a couple of weeks, just in my own head, where I try to take a, almost like the Green Lantern spectrum, and when I think of a certain creator, I try to attach a feeling or an emotion to that creator's work. So, you know, you've got things like I really attach fear to Frank Miller, because a lot of his work for me is based in the idea of fear and the hero having to overcome that fear in one way or another and coming out the other side better for it. Like, this is the an exercise. And when I think about, when I started thinking about Darwin Cook and going back and reading Darwin Cook, it's not that he shies away, and I don't want this to become what we used to call in the retail music industry as a dead spread, where if like a Frank Sinatra were to die or somebody, like, you'd be like, "All right, pull out the table and the black tablecloth.
Yeah,
let's put up all of the DVDs and all of the CDs from Frank.
Cause yeah, shine it off."
That's right. Blow the dust off. Here it comes. But the one thing that I can really associate with his work is hope. I was wondering if you could maybe take my thought and make it tangible, make it salient, because I'm having a real hard time doing that. This is what, like, a Jedi Cole justification on the fly of my own thoughts, so I want to see what you could do with that.
Wow. I may need to...
Because if you... I think that he entered the world of in a big way into the world of comics at a time when things were pretty dark and bleak. You know, you had... You know, if you look at when New Frontier came out, if you look at it when it came out at a time period when things were not at their best. It was 2003, 2004. So it is a post 9/11 world. We had things like DC's Civil War or Marvel's Civil War and DC's Fine. Everything was a crisis. Everything was coming down around your ears during that period of time. It was still pretty dark. We were coming out of the mid to late 90s where, you know, comics got a lot darker.
Yes, absolutely.
And what it did was it didn't shy away from the darkness. But when you read it, and it was through the art and it was through the storytelling that it you read it and you somehow knew just by reading it that everything was going to be okay. And I think that there's a lot of power in that, almost like a, you know, like a sigil, like a magic spell that you're casting. You're harnessing a power to make people feel good, I think. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree, and I think that there was a great period, and it's easy to point at certain things and say, you know, this was the great dark period.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that the comics have gone through those dark periods, and then they begin to try to brighten things up a little bit, and then dark again. And I think that a lot of it is a combination of two things. Is you have in comics the kind of the Dark Knight syndrome, as I call it, which happened with Warner and superhero films. After the Dark Knight, they thought, oh, well, that's what sells.
Right.
Is dark, brooding, terrible things. So we got to put the kibosh on this bright, sunny, friendly Captain or Shazam movie, rather, that we've got planned. There's no way anyone's going to line up for that.
Right. Nobody wants to see Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Shazam.
There's been this proof of concept. This is what sells. It's like, no, what sold was a very good movie. And if a very good movie is put forth under its own merit, then that's what sells. So sometimes it's driven by that. And sometimes it's driven by just this. I think things like The Dark Knight and Watchmen happening, you know, on one another's heels was very much a product of a kind of zeitgeist, if
yes,
you will.
I agree.
You had, you know, the time was right for that, for these particular creators. And that's where, you know, that was one of the more organic, one of the more natural ways that sort of thing happened.
I think that what I think also, and I know we've done episodes in this, and we will be far from done talking about this. But the more I think about it, the more I think of it as an echo chamber during this time period, where you had a 24-hour news cycle that was pretty doom and gloom, and then you had so you were being inundated with this idea that nothing was going to be okay. You know, we were in some never-ending wars. The threat of looming terror was over. You know, there were a lot of things being talked about.
Yeah, because something had to replace the oppressive, silent gloom and doom of the Cold War.
Right, exactly. This is quickly going to become a conspiracy theory podcast if we're not careful.
Because that came to its head with the made-for-television movie The Day After.
The Day After was a great television movie.
The Day After was a load of crap.
Oh, come on.
There's absolutely nothing that happened the day after.
Would you rather the boy and his dog? Would you rather that?
Well, possibly. At least the likelihood of the things occurring in that narrative were greater. But there's absolutely nothing that happened. And this is the last I'm going to say about it. But the people, as the missiles are flying, boys, at the grocery store, and the checkout people are there frantically ringing them up.
Right.
These guys will be like going over to the knife aisle. They'd be grabbing a side of beef, a gallon of water, and about three or four butcher knives on the way out, because it's survival. This is, you know, the white line nightmare of Road Warrior. That was like the day after. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Not that bad that quick.
Right. When it goes bad fast.
Yeah, so.
But
I know where you're headed with that.
But then you had comics, you know, because, and I'm sure it happened other places, but, you know, we are comic people, so that's what we pay attention to. You had Marvel and DC, and they were the big ones, and everybody kind of follows their lead until recently, but, you know, they had all these tuning forks that they would stick in this echo chamber and then hit. And then when it would bounce back, they'd say, well, people love this. So
yeah.
Let's make more. Let's put more tuning forks. And by the end, it was a cacophony of just resounding
it's
madness.
All the same tune.
It
was just the same tune off 40 or 50 forks.
You had this minor key tune playing in this thing that everybody was reading. Everybody was kind of it was just
it was like the Phantom fell asleep at his
Nice. I like that.
He was so tired, even the organ didn't wake him. It was just like...
But then you have this major key...
Shift a little, get into sleep.
resolved chord in the form of New Frontier hits.
Yes.
And it's very Norman Rockwell. It meets... Adam West Batman meets Kane and Finger meets Schuster meets, you know, it's bright, it's shiny, it has some happy endings. They don't shy away from, like, the what was the GI Combat guys that got trapped on Monster Island and slowly died off one by one. Like, holy, that was dark. It was dark.
Yeah, but that wasn't the underlying tone of the whole thing. And the production, from an editorial standpoint, there was a very specific approach to this.
Right.
That it be, even at its darkest, it's still a charming book.
Right.
Doesn't have to be all. And, you know, even the dark tales are told with a brighter color palette.
Exactly. And you get the idea that, because this is his creation, this is if you want to talk about his creation, this is his creation. You get the idea that he got sick of it. You know, that's basically what it came down to, was I can't take this anymore. I want to write something. I want to create something that reminds me of why I love comic books.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant. That's great. And that's exactly what we needed. And it will go down. New Frontiers, if you talk to anybody... who's a fan of comics, who's a fan of collected editions, inevitably, once you get past your Watchmans and past your Dark Knight Returns and past your, you know, you hit some, they will inevitably, it will come up, and then the reminiscing starts about how it made you feel. It's not even about the story, it's about how it made you feel, and that's so great. Darwin Cook did so many amazing things. And I'm not going to get into a litany. Like I said, I don't want this to become a eulogy for him. But look it up if you want.
He's certainly a creator that we need to celebrate posthumously in this case as one of our creator spotlights in the near future.
I agree. Cole, would you be okay with shifting gears to one of your favorite topics?
With myself?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Maybe one day, if you continue down this dark path you're on, let's talk about the comic book legal defense fund a little bit.
Yes, indeed. That is, if you really want to talk the comic book hero, the CBLDF is...
Oh, you know him like that, do you?
Gotta be part of the CBLDF community.
Come on with them. Come on with your emails. I'm here. I'll take it.
I got to get some emails to us somehow. Somebody's got to write eventually. So, but the Legal Defense Fund was created because the comic book, especially comic book retailers, but in some cases comic book creators, were such an easy target for legal. Persecution via prosecution, as it were.
Right.
Because they had no voice. You know, most comic retailers aren't going to be able to afford a protracted legal battle.
And if they can afford it, that money's coming out of the stockpile of funds that they have to keep their comic book shop open.
Precisely. And a lot of times that leads to the demise of the comic shop, or was. And someone had the wherewithal to say, why are we allowing this to happen? Because most of the time, these were very trumped-up charges. But, there was no recourse, no one to turn to who was willing to step up and say, hey, you know, you wouldn't go after, you know, you're going after mom and pop comic shop or just Pop's comic shop, for having in their inventory adult books, for which there's nothing illegal.
Right.
But you're trying to find a way to subvert the law because someone in the community doesn't agree with this.
Right.
And it's putting, you know, a handful of people's sensibilities ahead of the greater good of the community that is ideally why we have the laws we have. And so the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, I highly recommend if you can donate to this, because they do amazing work, both for creators and for art, and for especially the retailers, because they are oftentimes targeted. And I know I've mentioned on the show before that one of the more high-profile cases was a right here in Texas, where I am, yet another fine embarrassment by the imbecilic people that populate this state for some reason, where a comic shop was selling adult-oriented comics, and the sting operation consisted of sending an adult to buy adult comics.
Right. And then Costello versus Texas.
Ah, there we are.
Keith's Comics, of all places.
Yeah, so it was sort of like, where was the law broken?
Right.
The reality wasn't, but if you tie up someone in a legal battle, they can't afford to, they'll go away.
And
it's basically legalized strong-arming.
Yeah, it is. And what's really cool about this case is, and, you know, it was Demon Beast Invasion and Hero Sogodoshi, which we've mentioned on the show many times, otherwise known as Legend of the Overfiend, that were the problem, apparently.
Yeah.
Now, you could probably, and I do believe I've seen it, you could go into, like, Borders and find Legend of the Overfiend now. It's probably censored, but I believe they have that in their weird manga section there.
Yes, and, the, you know, there was another case, and I can't remember if the CBLDF was involved or not, but there was a comic book, an underground comic called Boiled Angel.
Yeah, oh God, I remember Boiled Angel.
There was a legal battle in New York City, I believe it was, where the judge actually ruled that the creator of Boiled Angel, based solely on the issues 7 and 8, which was ATE, and I've never seen Boiled Angel, but I remember reading
You haven't? Oh, Cole, I think I still have a copy of Boiled Angel somewhere around here.
Let me put it this way, I've seen Faust.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, do I need to, is there, can anything, I mean, Boiled Angel probably opens for Faust. I don't know, maybe. But that, you know, the judge actually ordered that the guy that created Boiled Angel could not even, for some, you know, probationary period, not even so much as draw. I mean, how? Where is the precedent for this? How is that? I just want Sam Watterson, you know, to come out and go, where does it end?
Where does it end? Dong dong. Take his pins away. Yeah, it was. And it's an interesting side note. In a 1990 review, Boiled Angel was called a prime candidate for banning in the 90s. But you gotta. Here's the other thing: when the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund,
apparently Diamond didn't carry Boiled Angel, but they did carry Faust. You know,
gross. Yeah, listen. I support free speech even for bad comics. So
yeah.
If you want to put out a crap comic, feel free. Chances are I'll read it at some point in my life.
And I think that that's an important thing that often gets overlooked, is that part of having prescribed freedoms is respecting prescribed freedoms.
Right.
And censorship flies in the face of that.
Well, and
because, you know, the idea is you're not obliged to agree. You're not obliged to like, but you are obliged to respect that other people can have opinions or express themselves in ways that you don't agree with. And that's something I think gets lost in the shuffle sometimes, in the fervor of, you know, beating the drum of anti-fill-in-the-blank.
Well, and also keep in mind, we're talking about 1986, when the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund was Comic Book Legal Defense Fund was initiated and put into place. That was a year after the Tipper Gore Parental Advisory, the Parents Music Resource Center went into effect, with the parental advisory stickers on CDs and tapes. Tapes more than CDs in 85. But so, at some point, obviously it worked for that, so they turned their eyes to other obscene materials that they could then put a stamp on and say, if you don't follow our rules, we're going to lock you down. It's almost like, at some point, like, it becomes the person in the town that people think can point out a witch. you know, and they start using their powers just to point out people they don't like in the town, you know, throwing red herrings. Like, it's an obscene comic. No, it's just a bad comic. There's
yeah,
a difference.
Exactly.
It's not obscene. It's just shit. Granted, we all agree that that Bloodshot from Image is crap, but it's not obscene. Like, they can sell it, and just nobody will buy it. Let the market work it out, but...
Yeah, and I think I've talked before about, you know, some of the stuff about the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, but they certainly are there, you know, to be that advocacy for those who had none.
Right.
And like you're saying, you know, it may not be your bag, baby, but it doesn't mean that it shouldn't exist. It, you know...
Yeah.
You kind of want to be like, you know, Henry Jones Sr. and say, you know, this... morons like you should read comics instead of banning them.
That was a pretty good show. That was pretty good Connery.
But I'm also, I always, when I talk about the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, there was a quote that is often attributed to Voltaire, but it was actually written by a biographer of
Voltaire's.
And I've been guilty of attributing this to Voltaire, but it's actually Evelyn Beatrice Hall, who in her biography, The Life of Voltaire, or actually she in her she also written The Friends of Voltaire. It's surprising that he had friends, but it was actually in the book The Friends of Voltaire that she coined the phrase, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." And I
right.
think that is the part that people miss.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the spirit of what, you know, that's the spirit behind these true heroes of comics who go out there and represent for people whose rights are being trounced in the name of good or right or moral or what have you. And it's like, that's not an option. You don't get to make those choices.
And and one last, I guess, as we bring this to a close, one last organization I really want to talk about, and actually Thomas brought it up on our last show, and I had it down here that I wanted to talk about it, and I'm glad that we're having the opportunity, is speaking of those auctions that you see, I don't know whether the James O'Barr auction was for this or another charity, but the one you'll see a lot when you're out, and it's worth giving money to, is the Hero Initiative. The Hero Initiative is a charity that, because believe it or not, regardless of whether you read their books every month or see their names, you know, in the bylines of a comic book movie, comic book creators don't make a ton of money.
Yeah.
What this charity does is collect money through things like auctions and art auctions and giveaways and strict donations to turn around and be able to give that money back to creators who have fallen on times of extreme monetary duress through, let's say, illness or a car accident or
yeah, in fact, most commonly it is things like that, medical concerns that will just pretty much derail the life of somebody who's, you know, they're making a decent living.
Right, right.
And, you know, they're struck with a catastrophic illness or an accident or something like that, and suddenly, you know, there's no other recourse. You know, they don't have get sick time.
Right. They absolutely don't. And then they have to keep working to make money. And if something affects their ability to, you know, they don't get paid time off. They don't get FMLA for the most part. So if something happens, these guys...
Is that like FMLA community?
Yes, the FMLA community. People that, you know, identify as having to, you know, leave because they had a child or something like that.
That's right. I actually had children, but I identify as a parent.
You know, because we talked in the first issue of this story arc about work for hire contracts, and that's basically what we're looking at. Is you know, and there are some restrictions on who can apply for this aid, but basically anybody who's been a comic creator for a while can apply for aid, which is huge. Like,
yeah,
it's an insane thing to do, and their president, Jim McLaughlin, who used to be the Top Cow editor-in-chief, which, if you know, back when Top Cow was first getting going, Brian Peluto's been in it, Joe Quesada's been a member of it, they have close ties to Guillermo del Toro, It's huge. And if you've ever heard of Dynamic Forces, they work directly in conjunction with the Hero Initiative.
Yeah, Dynamic Forces does a lot of kind of aftermarket publishing and stuff like that, where they'll, arrange autograph editions and stuff like that as well.
Right. And if you go over to Dynamic Forces, you can give money right there on the spot. So that's, I mean, the thing is, it's these charities are so integral to the thing that we love, but they work behind the scenes and we never see it happen. Every once in a while, and again, we were talking about Bader Meinhof, you don't think about it until you start seeing it. But if you look for it, you'll see that this is out there, that these charities support the people that we've come to recognize as a second family, trying to put out, books that make us feel good, or books that make us think, or content that makes us smile or gasp or whatever it might be. So support them, I think, is the most important thing. If you go to heroinitiative.org, you can give there. Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, you can give there. But it's wildly important. And like you were saying about James O'Barr, I got to witness one Heroes Initiative art auction. It was at HeroCon, of all things, shockingly, in North Carolina, and it was awesome, because they all, you get a bunch of artists, they kind of take turns in the booth, as it was. They had a cordoned off area where they would go create their art for the art auction on the spot, and it's amazing to watch. And it's amazing to then watch, like you were saying with James O'Barr, it's amazing to then watch these guys who have taken their time and, like you said, could probably sell these things for a fair amount of money, turn around and just give them away to charity.
Oh, yeah. Like, in fact, you were speaking of the Hero Initiative. In the past, you really had to be, somebody in the community, or really have touched a lot of the professional community lives. There, you used to occasionally hear about an artist or writer falling on some difficult times, usually due to illness, and there was kind of like an underground fundraising movement going on.
Right.
But it's nice to know there is an organization that can kind of take the place of that necessity, because it's a lot harder for those things to get their ball rolling and get the money rolling in and such. But for example, when Reed Waller, this is kind of an interesting case of doing good bad work,
yeah,
as it were, because he was effectively an adult underground cartoonist,
right,
who created a dirty book.
Oh no.
But it was, it was a sexually explicit book that was very well written, especially once late Kate Worley came on board, who ironically would go on to write Little Mermaid comics for Disney Comics. I always thought that was just a wonderful little bit of irony. She used to write Omar the Cat Dancer for adults, and you're on the opposite end of the spectrum. But when he was extremely ill, his publisher actually published two volumes of basically collections of art that was donated for a kind of fundraiser book.
Okay.
And, all the proceeds went to Reed Waller, who created Omaha. It was his Omaha tribute. I think it was called Images of Omaha. And there were two volumes of it. And it was really remarkable to see that the community coming together that much, especially for a creator who was not as high profile as your, other, like Frank Miller or...
Right.
Alan Moore, people like that at the time. But it did speak volumes about that community, that it very much takes care of its own. And I think, especially with the advent of the internet, it can take care of its own even on a broader scale.
Right. And I think that the last thing I want to say here before we come in to wrap the show up is that the Heroes Initiative was not created by a man in an ivory tower somewhere. And I think this is an important thing to note if we're talking about heroes in the comic book community. It was created by comic book creators that had known people that had fallen on hard times. And because of draconian rule sets, like we talked about in the first issue of this story arc, could not support themselves.
Yeah.
So they came together to create a charity, not for themselves, it wasn't their money, but to support friends in the industry that would fall into a period of time where they needed support. And it has grown since then to be a mammoth undertaking of charitable work, and it deserves to be recognized for what it is, which is a good work. You know, you look upon my works, ye mighty, and tremble. Some of those works can be good works.
Yes, absolutely. And I've seen several other charities where Heroes and Fantasies in San Antonio years ago was involved in a charity event each year, and I got the chance to see some of the donated artwork, both original art and prints and things like that that were hard to find. And it was amazing how many very high-profile artists were taking time out to make, you know, not just this little half-ass sketch you do in 5 minutes.
Right.
But very elaborate original work that they donated, or, you know, existing original work from their archive for auctions and stuff. And it's always remarkable to see that sort of thing playing out. And another kind of fun little unsung hero, and we've never really touched on this on this show, Eddie and I on the Rancor Pit did an episode called The Altruistic Side of the Force.
Nice.
And we talked about all the different, you know, how the Star Wars community had come together for various individuals or for larger groups. And
sure.
Things like the efforts of the 501st Legion to come absolutely. And visit the hospitals. But there are a lot in the Dallas area. I know there are some, and I suspect this has played out all over the nation, where there are local cosplay groups who will go and gather, you know, some of their membership will gather together and have, you know, appear at children's hospitals or help with charity events and stuff like that to be kind of that extra audience draw, or to liven up the day of some kids in the hospital and things like that, which is absolutely wonderful as well.
Exactly. And so, see, it's not all bad. It's not all bad. We're a close-knit community that comes together when we need to support each other, to support the people around us, to give back. So, you know, while we've done three solid issues on awful, awful people doing awful, awful things, and we've got one more humdinger of an issue coming.
Yes,
oh,
we do.
Man, it's so worth the wait. It's so good.
This one is a story that you know, it literally falls in the purview you can't make this stuff up, you know, because you could make it up, but it wouldn't be nearly what this was. I mean, the reality is beyond the fiction, and
for sure. But there are good works being done. So, you know, at the Jedi Cole Universe, we implore you, go seek out those good works. You know, if you are a cosplayer, go to a hospital and do some charity. I got to witness that. You're absolutely right, Cole. I got to witness that happen live over the summer. It's great. If you can find a children's hospital and you can show up in costume, the kids absolutely love it. You know, if you can volunteer, even if you don't have a costume per se, you know, you can do things to volunteer and help out for any of these causes. You can volunteer for the Hero Initiative. You can volunteer for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. They're always looking for people that that'll table for them at shows and things like that. If you're interested, get involved. Talk to people. Do your own charity auctions. I mean, Cole and I give away crappy comic books all the time. It's a win-win. We're giving back and we're getting rid of our crappy comic books. But still, you know, just do something. Do something heroic. You sit around and read comic books about heroes all day long. You are a hero. Go out and do it. I think is my final thought on that. Cole, what do you got?
Well, I want to close with, it occurred to me, I really want to dedicate this issue of Hey Kids Comics to one of our Texas heroes who we lost a couple of years ago. It was a young man named Jonathan Vila.
Yeah.
Or Vila. I actually met him a couple of times at some conventions. He was also known as as Aquaman San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And just the most friendly, happy, personable guy you'd ever want to meet. And of course, you know, if you're giving Aquaman, especially the classic Aquaman, some love, I'm all for that.
Right.
And but back in, I think, 2014, if I'm not mistaken, he passed away from a stroke. But as I said, I saw him at a couple of comic conventions and would later discover he was very involved in appearing in his Aquaman costume for a lot of things like autism awareness events and a lot of other charities. So he was, you know, embracing, like so many in the cosplay community do so well, not only, you know, getting out there and being the character they love, but also, you know, taking that a step further.
Right.
And his passing really impacted a lot of people on the Texas convention scene because he was such a presence. And what was wonderful, you know, we hear a lot about the cosplay body shaming that, you know, we're led to believe runs far more rampant than it does, which is not to say that it doesn't exist. It sadly does exist in a big way, but I don't think it's nearly as prevalent
as Tumblr would have you believe.
Exactly, or as, you know, we're led to believe because a handful of people go on the internet and make that their mission because that's all they have.
Right.
And it magnifies the reality. But, you know, he was a larger guy, and he was embracing this character and never, you know, flinched. He was out there just having fun and greeting people and posing for pictures. But, you know, the fact that he was also took that step further. And those are the local heroes that we really, I think I wanted to, you know, pay tribute to him because he is among that breed of cosplayer who take that step further and go out there and just enrich people's lives.
Well, and
they love at the same time.
We can do this all night, but we could go point by point the amazing people that we know. And matter of fact, I want to do one more because you invoked in me something that it hadn't occurred to me until just now, is that Cole and myself to a lesser extent, but certainly Cole knows a member of cosplay charitable royalty in Texas, is actually good friends with one, and we've actually done an issue in her honor already, and that's no less than Percala.
Oh yes,
yes. Was on the Who Wants to Be a Superhero show with Stan Lee. Got voted off fairly early, but did not give up the cat costume and will appear at conventions or has appeared at conventions. Face paints for children. Really goes out of her way for the kids.
That's right, for the kids.
And that's,
yeah, because she amazing. Would tirelessly face paint at conventions at a table that, you know, she and her husband, Tom, had paid for, you know, for hours and hours, and, you know, refused all payment to herself and just encouraged anyone who felt that they just had to pay something to donate to several feline animal shelters to, you know, she was there doing what she loved, and if it served a better purpose beyond that, so be it.
Right, right. So, you know, it's one of those, it's God bless you, because I don't know many people that would do what she does and love it as much as she does. So, all right, let's wrap this up. It's time. Why don't you plug us up and we'll get out of here, because we had a lot of prep to do for next week's episode.
Absolutely, and we have gone this arc from, and apologies for the coming and going of this arc, but we're back on track now and very happy about that. But you know, we've gone from the dark depths of greed and malfeasance to now we're the, you know, the lofty heights of altruism, and now next week we're gonna delve into this side of the twilight zone of
so
comic
good.
Book tales. So we'll leave it there for now, and in the meantime, you are, of course, listening to us from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com, and do stay tuned into the summer, because it's going to get pretty cool over here. and if you're listening to this show, you might have come to just like rush in, give it a listen before it disappeared off the feed. As you're listening, I've been meticulously taking away all of those dead links that had been degrading at an alarming rate lately, and replaced them with full embeds, which finally worked for me. So you're going to see that aspect of the JCU improve vastly, where within the next couple of months I will have reestablished nearly 300 shows. Whew. And beyond that, all the new shows will be embedded at the upfront, but it's just going to even get better still. So thank you for everybody who's been very patient while we're getting the old stuff back online. And so be sure and check all that out, and then you can write to us if you have suggestions for a new story arc or something you'd like to hear about, or you want to ask us questions, because we would love to get some audience questions to do another Hey Kids Comics Presents.
Right.
It's been a long time. And, just write to us about anything. Just let us know how we're doing. We'd just love to hear from you. We know people are out there listening, so don't be scared. Send us a note. And watch the Twitter feed. Follow us on Twitter at the Jedi Cole U, because you're going to want to know when these things are when the big changes are coming, because they're going to be here.
What's the email address they can write us at?
Oh, I was so busy talking about email I didn't mention the address, which is jcumail@yahoo.com. And I'm going to be working pretty soon here with the Vega Bomber himself, PJ Dunn, who does the soon-to-be have his entire show reestablished do-it-yourself here at the JCU, to get a little more video content up and running as
nice.
Well. And with that, we'll be back in a week with, this time exactly a week.
With
strange, you want to see something scary, and then it's just turns out Dan Aykroyd in makeup.
this is one of those
that's only slightly scarier than Dan Aykroyd
that you can file under the weirdest news, the weirdest comic book news ever. So join us next week for the end of this story arc. Then we're going to jump into a few standalone issues, and then we'll probably find our way back into a story arc shortly thereafter, because Cole and I are glutton for punishment. Thank you all so much for continuing to listen. Like Cole said, thank you for your patience while we're going through a lot of technical stuff and issues, and I guarantee you a positive change is coming soon in our web presence and up in the quality of we've been up in the quality of our research recently, and we've really been taking our time trying to make a quality product, and we appreciate that patience while we work through these growing pains. We're not going anywhere. We're creeping up on 200. I see 300 right. In our future. It's just another lap around the track. We can do that.
I'm going to announce it right here. Issue 300 will be about 300.
That is a great idea. That we got a target now. I just painted it on the wall. Issue 300 is about 300.
You're going to get Leonidas on your ass.
We might get Leonidas on this show.
Yeah,
if we make it to issue 300 without keeling over at some point, we will have Leonidas on this show. All right, everybody, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics. Give to your comic book charities. They need your money, and they are way more appreciative of it than I would be if you were just buying my back issues of Wild Cards. I love y'all dearly. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week for the final issue of this story arc. Get your bidding paddles ready and your clean out your storage units. It's going to be a blast.